Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome to Jerusalem Unplugged, the only podcast dedicated to Jerusalem, its history, and its people. Your host, Roberto Mazza, will bring you guests discussing their relationship with the Holy City. A journey through history, society, feelings, and hopes for the future. Follow the podcast on all social media platforms at Jerusalem Unplugged.
Hi, I am Roberto Mazza, and this is Jerusalem Unplugged, your getaway into the multi-layer narratives of this iconic city. Each episode, I'll guide you through Jerusalem's mesmerizing chronicles and present-day realities. With leading experts as guests, we'll examine the city's intricate past, raging socio-political debates, and nuances of its cosmopolitan culture. Let this podcast be your immersive audio expedition, allowing you to experience the spiritual resonance, political tension, and dynamic voices that define Jerusalem's powerful mystery. Join me on this thought-provoking journey into one of the world's most fascinating places that has captivated everybody for centuries. Welcome back to the second part of our in-depth exploration of Zionism on Jerusalem Unplugged. In our previous episode, we were joined by Professor Arya Dubnov, who delved into the origins and development of this influential nationalist ideology from its early beginning through the tumultuous events leading up to 1948. Today we'll pick up that thread as Professor Dubnov provides insight into the pre-state paramilitary organizations like the Haganah, Irgun, and Lehi that played crucial roles in the lead-up to the creation of the State of Israel in 1948. Their histories and differing ideological leanings set the stage for the fissures and fragmentation that emerged within the Zionist movement after 1948. From there, Professor Dubnov will trace how Zionist thought and praxis transformed over the following decades, analyzing the diverse social, political, and intellectual currents that arose. We confront head-on the multifaceted realities and ongoing debates surrounding Zionism's place in Israel and indeed the world today. The second installment promised to shed light on complex dynamics, pivotal events, and evolving ideological landscape of Zionism from a midpoint of the 20th century into our contemporary era. Without further ado, we delve immediately into the second part of the interview with Arya Dubnov. I want to ask about a phenomenon that developed in Palestine during the Mandate. Is that various Zionist organizations also saw the development of paramilitary organizations, which was very common at the time, obviously throughout Europe with the fascist Nazi organizations and others. So it's not a unique phenomenon. But what I found interesting is that, you know, when today we look at the ELO, then adopted by Hamas symbolism, the weapons and the land, you know, similar symbols were also adopted by Zionist paramilitary organizations during the mandate. And so I was wondering if you can just tell us a little bit more about the various organizations and also their goals and identity.
Right, absolutely. So I think that it's very good that we talked about the British Empire, because this is the framework in which these paramilitary organizations are established. And if there's a very important misconception or a tendency that the of our anachronistic reading of these developments is very prone, is that we assume that all these armed forces are underground, secret or semi-secret organizations that are doing things under the noses of the British and often against the British. And actually, the picture is much, much more complicated. Because the situation in Mandatory Palestine, exactly after there is a system, there's a government, there's a mandatory government running the show in Palestine from 1922 onwards, with a head, with a high commissioner and a system of government, is that the British understand very clearly that it actually makes, you know, colonial policing much more efficient if you have locals also policing and guarding themselves. So if you think about an organization like the Haganah that was established in May 1920, it's not an underground secret movement. It's something that is done with the blessing of the British. It's a self-defense for the Jews, but it's actually taking its orders from the Jewish agency and from David Ben-Gurion, that are not doing whatever they want. They are an arm of, they need to report to the British mandatory regime. And this will be a very well-organized military power that will gain relatively good training in quasi-military operations. Again, not to the level of mass battalions, but definitely to the level of platoons and so on. And when World War II will break out, and when Rommel's forces would reach North Africa, and there was an impending invasion and a fear that Palestine would be the next in line, and if Egypt would fall, they would enter Palestine, it would be the British that would allow the Yishuv, the Jewish community in Palestine, to establish an elite force called the Palmach, striking force, in May 1941. And more so, in between these two events, you also have the Great Arab Revolt between 1936 to 1939. And when the British need to think about how to suppress that revolt and the type of counterinsurgency tactics they're using, so of course they're sending British troops to Palestine, but they're also working with local native-born Jews. So if you think about the first baptisms of fire of what people that would later become very famous figures in the Israeli army and later politics, Yigal Alon, Yitzhak Rabin, even Moshe Dayan, many of these men, their first baptism of fire was even before the Palmach was established in 1941. They were working with Ord Wingate, the famous British secret intelligence officer in suppressing this. Now, I mentioned these groups, Palmach and Haganah, that are working vis-a-vis the British, because it's very important to distinguish them from the groups, the splinter groups that emerge in the 1930s and 40s that are affiliated with revisionist Zionism. So, pause for a second. What is revisionist Zionism? Already in the mid-1920s, you will see a more militant, hawkish Zionist leader by the name of Vladimir Zev Jabotinsky starting to question the policies of mainstream Zionism, pushing back against Chaim Weizmann, accusing Weizmann and the leadership of being too Anglophile, of working too much closely with the British, and even looking at the White Paper of 1921. That's the Churchill White Paper that establishes the borders of Palestine and separating it from Transjordan as some sort of tour as a cut of the land, imagining a greater land of Israel in which River Jordan is not the border of Palestine, but actually it's the, if you'd like, the axis, it's the center, it's the spinal cord of Palestine that they imagine would be a vast territory from the Mediterranean in all the way into what is today the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan. And in 1931, they will establish a group that is calling itself ETZEL, which is an acronym for Irgun Tzva'i Lumi. Many times in English sources, it's simply called the Irgun. And the Irgun is established first because they are not very happy about the fact that the British authorities and the Jewish agency is calling for restraint and not to revenge against cases of violence inflicted against the Jewish communities or Jewish individuals. They want a much more robust and a hawkish attitude to when it comes to defense. And their emblem, and I invite listeners to just Google the emblem of the Etzel, Irgun Tzva'i Lumi, speaks for their ideology. You will see the map of Greater Land of Israel, and at the backstage, like the symbol of Beitar, the youth movement of the revisionist movement. And at the front, you will see an arm holding a rifle. And the message is, of course, the way for Zionism to succeed is not through these charters and agreements and permissions from superpowers. It will be done by force. Uri Zvi Grinberg, one of the, you know, fascist poets that the Etzel fighters would really memorize his poems by heart, would speak in these language. Moledet lo nikne, moledet niknet bedam. The homeland is being purchased by blood, not through agreements, not through diplomacy. In June 1940, an even additional smaller splinter group calling itself Lehi will be established. This is already in the context of the first stages of World War II. It's headed by a charismatic figure by the name of Avraham Yair Stern. So again, many of the listeners probably heard of it simply through the name the British gave it, the Stern Gang. And this is already a terror group, and they're definitely a secret. They are following a robust anti-colonial ideology. They are targeting both Palestinians, but also British facilities. They are not shying away from assassinating British officers and others, and they will make the life of the British miserable. Maybe the most famous or infamous case was the assassination of Lord Moyne, that was assassinated in Cairo in 1944 by members of the Lehi, Natan Friedman Yalin, someone that was then called Yitzhak Yezernitsky. We know him as Yitzhak Shamir, that would later become one of Israel's prime ministers. And it's very important to remember those Lehi veterans and so on, because they are really truly see themselves as fighting the British as a foreign colonial power. So if sometimes you will see sometimes that things that would sound odd to us today, that very right-wing or hawkish Zionists that are saying Zionism in itself was an anti-colonial movement of freedom fighters, this is the classic language of those revisionist splinter groups. And this is definitely the rhetoric of Menachem Begin, that was at a certain stage the head of the Etzel, and so on. So it's very important to distinguish them and to remember that there was a clear rivalry between these groups. So there was a period in which the British were hunting down the Lehi and were calling upon the Haganah to find the members of the Lehi and capture them and give them to the British authorities. And this is part of what galvanized intra-Zionist debates between right and left, And this was a period that the members of those revisionist paramilitary groups called the saison, the hunting season, in which we were hunted down not only by the British secret police and authorities, but even those members of Haganah and Palmach were willing to find us and capture us and surrender us to the British authorities, which would later will have a huge effect on internal debates in Israel between right and left.
And eventually, in 1948, Labor Zionism under David Ben-Gurion became the dominant form of Zionism. So I was wondering if you could tell us, you know, what the change about Zionism after 1948?
Yeah, it's a fantastic question. And it's fantastic because there are no simple answers to it. On many ways, one can say that the pre-1948 internal divisions and branches that I just described were reproduced, and still you can see kind of these internal divisions within Israel today, but in others are demolished and became irrelevant today. So let's kind of try and separate between the two. So where I think the things reproduce themselves. So definitely if you look at the map of the parties, if you look at the political map in the first Knesset, the Israeli parliament, you will see very clearly that the dominant party, Mapai, which is kind of the big party of the labor movement, headed by David Ben-Gurion, would be the dominant force in the newly established Israel, and it will basically run the show up to 1977. And as an anecdote, I will say that it's not surprising to see a very, very similar trajectory to the Congress Party in India, that again, the main political force that was there pre-1947 and will become the major party in the new and independent India. So the same thing and almost the exact same dates that these parties fall from power and so on and so forth. And I mentioned, of course, revisionist Zionism, the arch enemy of the labor Zionist. So the veterans of the Etzel and the same commander of the Etzel, Menachem Begin, will establish a party calling itself Chirut, Liberty in Hebrew. And this is the party of the veterans of those paramilitary groups. Even the symbol of Tnuat HaChirut, the Chirut movement, will be the same emblems of the Etzel. But this is the precursor of forerunners of the Likud party. It will take Menachem Begin many years as a leader of opposition to understand that he needs to start opening his rank and invite and merge with other parties such as Gachal and so on to create the modern Likud, eventually eclipsing the Labor Party in the elections of 1977. So definitely, if you think about the genesis of the major political parties of Israel after 1948, these internal divisions are extremely clear, and they reproduce themselves. This said, 1948 is a huge game changer. Of course, it's a game changer because of Nakba. You know, the profile, the demographic profile in Palestine changes radically when 750,000 Palestinians are either fleeing or expelled from their houses. And more important than that, the new state establishes mechanisms that would not allow them to return to their houses and will use the law of return to invite Jewish immigrants into Palestine. And of course, the immigrations, the mass immigrations into Israel in its first decades, you know, both from Middle Eastern and North African states, such as Iraq and Yemen and Morocco, but also from Central European and East European countries, from Romania and Poland, people that were in DP camps after the Holocaust and so on. So very clearly, quickly, after after by the early 50s, Palestinians are a minority in their home, in their own home. Yes, there is Palestinians that are citizens of Israel that are subjected to the military rule up to 1966, but the demographic changes radically, and the divisions even between labor Zionist ideology and revisionist Zionist ideology sometimes become slightly, I would argue, not that relevant when you think about the military apparatus and the military ethos that is developed in the early state. Perhaps one good example would be the famous figure of Moshe Dayan, the one-eyed general that was the chief of staff in the 50s, later on the minister of defense during the 1967 war. Moshe Dayan is coming from hardcore labor Zionist background. He's coming from a family, it's really a Kennedy dynasty, if you'd like, of socialist Zionists. He's growing up in Nahalal, which is perhaps one of the, you know, poster collective settlements that that symbolize the socialist ethos of Zionism. But as a general, and especially as a chief of staff of the Israeli army in the early 50s, the type of ethos and the type of sentiment that expresses in his letters and speeches is actually very similar to Vladimir Jabotinsky's Iron Wall. So in a way, ideas and collaborations that would be almost seen as inconceivable before 1948 are disappearing later on. And definitely after 1967, when new territories come under Israeli control and Israel occupies the West Bank and Gaza, and a new movement calling itself the Movement of Greater Israel is established really weeks after the war, you will see in that movement thinkers that are coming from such diverse backgrounds and coming from party backgrounds that would seem to us as almost oil and water in pre-1948 years. It will include a labor Zionist poet like Nathan Alterman, or a novelist who's coming from a Marxist Zionist background like Moshe Shamir, next to Israel Beldad, who's up and Uri Zvi Greenberg, who were the most famous figures, intellectuals of the revisionist right. So these are people that before 1948 will be rivals. You will have their secular figures, and you'll have their religious settlers, religious Zionists as well. And in a way, after 1967, religious Zionism that was there as an undercurrent all the time really moved to the forefront with the rise of Gush Emunim, that movement of religious settlers. Gush Emunim literally means block of the faithful. And it's not very symbolic that for Gush Emunim, one of their guru figures, the key figure that would inspire them, would be a different Rabbi Cook, Rabbi Tzvi Yehuda Cook, but this is the son of the same Rabbi Cook that we alluded to earlier, and he will really encourage religious settlers to create settlements in the West Bank, emphasizing the religious significance, and that's part of the story I assure many of our listeners are familiar with of Israel after 1967.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I have a couple of more questions about Zionism today, but I want to ask something about race. Because recently I started reading a book about the Black Panthers. But not the Black Panthers in America, but Israel's Black Panthers. And the whole point is that it shows an internal form of racism within Israeli society between obviously Ashkenazi Jews and Mizrahi Jews. And so I was trying to kind of like connect with a more contemporary discourse that we can see obviously nowadays, but already starting a couple of decades ago, equating Zionism with racism. And so I was wondering if you can elaborate more about the relationship between Zionism and race, but also the racialization question.
Right. Well, it's a very complicated question because it involves both kind of internal intra-Jewish division and racialization and looking at Jews from MENA countries, Middle Eastern and North African countries, and starting to see them as Oriental Jews and creation of a new, really modern category of Mizrahi Jews and how it plays out. And also debates of the 1970s that start equating Zionism with racism. So let's try and unpack these two. And I think that what is important to remember is that mass immigration to Israel in its early decades that really changes the intra-Jewish profile and the demographic profile in Israel. So if we think about the pre-1948 Jewish yeshuv, the Jewish community in Palestine, yes, you had some Jews that are Sephardi. This is what sometimes is called Hayeshuv Hayashan, the old yeshuv, or Samech Tetim, people that can trace their ancestry to the Jews that were expelled from the Iberian Peninsula. This is the literal meaning of Sephard or Sephardi in Jewish, it has its influence also in culture and liturgy and so on. But that's not the same as Mizrahi, which is a new category that started emerging in late Mandate and early state Israel, which Mizrahi is a word in Hebrew that means Eastern or Oriental. You won't be surprised to hear that it started as a bit of a derogatory term, right? That often the leaders of the main Zionist organs and institutions were predominantly European Jews, whether they are East European Jews or Central European Jews, but they tended to look down at many of the North African and Middle Eastern Jews. They, in some extreme cases, saw them as half-savages, but there were also techniques that of discrimination that were put haphazardly when the state was very young, in which you almost channeled different communities of immigrants to different areas. So it won't be surprising to see that many Jews that came from North Africa, from Morocco, will be sent to peripheral towns and development towns, while Jews that came from European countries would be assumed to be naturally white-collar workers. They will find their place in Israel's urban centers more quickly and so on. So it created like an internal intra-Jewish discrimination in Israel. And you already had signs, first signs of revolt emerging already in Haifa, in Wadi Nisnas, early in the early years, but it really reached almost a peak in the 70s, during the time that Golda Meir was the Israeli prime minister, and in that window, few very short but dramatic years between 1967 and the 1973 war, with the creation of a new protest movement calling itself the Israeli Black Panthers. It's a fascinating story. Yes, the name Black Panthers is taken. It's from the American Black Panthers, and these are predominantly young. These are predominantly second generation Mizrahi Jews. Most of them are coming from the Musarra neighborhood in Jerusalem. Most of them even didn't graduate high school. They came from very poor families, and they are starting to call upon the Israeli government to fight the discrimination that looks at them as second class citizens within Israel. Those of the listeners that will visit Jerusalem in the near future, I would recommend maybe making a short cut and visit the Musrara neighborhood, where visitors can go through an alley that was given the name the They Are Not Nice Alley. It's a funny anecdote, but an important story. There was a famous demonstration of the Black Panthers that ended up with violence, and many of the activists were arrested. And after the day of that protest, Golda Meir, the prime minister at the time, referred to the Black Panthers as not nice. They are not nice. And this became a phrase or a slogan that then was used against Golda Meir and against the Labour Party as symbolizing their patronistic and very kind of a attitude that looks down at the Mizrahi Jews, that belittles them, that is not recognizing their pain and discrimination. And many would argue that part of what helps explaining the really meteoric rise of the Likud party in and leading to the famous Mahapach turnover of 1977 was the way in which Menachem Begin was very good at tuning into the feeling of discrimination of the Mizrahi Jews and saying, while the Labour Party is really this old white European elite of socialist Jews that are looking down at you, and are secular Jews that are looking down at your traditions and your diets and your customs, you will feel at home with me in the Likud. And this is very, very dominant if you even tune in and listen to speeches that Menachem Begin was given in 1977 and later on in 1981. So this, combined with the huge trauma that the Israelis experienced in the 1973 war and economic processes, is often, these are like the factors that many historians of Israel will say can explain the way in which the Labour Party, that was seen as this invincible mothership up to 1977, is crashing down and in 97 and is replaced by the Likud party almost 50 years ago.
I have one last but multi-layer question. How would you characterize Zionism today? In other words, is still a plural entity? And secondly, and this is my view and understanding of Zionism today in the larger context, given that we see a number of new forms of nationalism that are developing around the world, mostly connected to religious identity. In America, we can see the rise of Christian nationalism. In India, Hindu nationalism, and obviously around the world, other similar forms. Is Zionism too turning into a religious form of nationalism?
Yeah, it's a super complicated and fascinating question that sometimes I feel as if You know, it forces me as a historian to make forays into fields I know little about, and maybe sociologists, political scientists, and prophets will have better answers than myself. But I will try to answer it in the following sense. You know, the question itself begs, like, without going into deep philosophy, the question of really what is the meaning of the word Zionism after 1948? Even if we assume that political Zionism, you know, was aiming to create a state, okay, so given the fact that, you know, it was a partition resolution in 1947, Ben-Gurion established a state and declared independence in 1948. In a way, one could argue that from that moment on, we moved into a phase that we can call almost post-Zionist. Post-Zionist in the literal sense, that we moved to the next stage, right? And the movement itself accomplished its mission, and let's move on to the next stage. And of course, I'm using this term provocatively because, of course, this is the difference between philosophical thinking and realities on the ground. Zionism continued to be seen as the main state ideology and the raison d'être, but it gained new meanings and it gained new importance. I think you alluded to two important elements. One is populism, and the second one is religiosity and religious, I would even say, fanaticism in many respects. So populism is a huge subject we won't be able to cover. And populism is, of course, a global phenomenon. So if you'd like, it's a global disease, but each place has its local symptoms. So the rise of new forms of quasi-authoritarian or fully authoritarian or big, strong leaders that are questioning the type of liberal and democratic ethos that was seen as prevalent after World War II and the replacement by a strongman type of politics is not unique to Israel, but in Israel, it maps onto the cleavages that are connected to, of course, the conflict with the Palestinians and the regional dimension, and also the intra-Israeli profiles and divisions between religious and secular, between Mizrahi and Ashkenazi, between rich and poor, and so on and so forth. And today, the word Zionism in intra-Israeli debates is often used in a way by different political parties to exclude their rivals, right? So it could be used in different by a liberal Zionist that will go back and revisit, as we just did actually earlier today, Herzl's utopian novel, and will say there was a social democratic model of a state that will allow multiple opinions, but checking at bay religious fanaticism, and these religious settlers are actually hijacking the Zionist ideas. At the same time, the religious settler movement will emphasize their self-understanding, seeing themselves as actually continuing the settler kind of ethos of the early pioneers and colonists, while the secular Jews exhausted their energy, the torch passed to us, and actually all these Tel Avivians forgot what it means to be a Zionist, and of course, in some cases, they will say they forgot what it means to be a Jew. So in a way, Zionism inside Israel becomes sort of this tag that you're using to fight internally between different fractions and different ideologies that has often this kind of a cherry-picking element of how one wants to read Zionism. Of course, when you move outside Israel to think about Zionism out in a global context, it has really, really different ramifications. And of course, part of it has to do with also weaponizations of a very crude tunnel vision and reading of Zionism, and also in contemporary debates about definition of anti-Semitism. Those of you who are familiar with the endless debates about the definition of anti-Semitism that was offered by a group called IHRA, the IHRA, the International Holocaust Remembrance Organization, their way in which they are trying to blur any type of distinction between accusations of anti-Semitism and criticism of Israeli policy and and thinking about Jewishness as embedded in the idea of Jewish national independence, and any questioning of Jewish independence as anti-Semitic is, of course, for me as a historian, is amusing and ironic, right? You know, I can offer numerous examples of not only Jews but even Zionists that were not necessarily thinking about a nation state in a sense, in the way that it was established. And secondly is the religious element that also is not only playing on the domestic field but also has ramifications outside. And you won't find it surprising, especially in North America, that an evangelical right is often the ones that are supporting contemporary Israel in the most robust way. And we alluded to India once in this podcast, so we can also mark the surprising strong connection between Israel under Benjamin Netanyahu and India under Narendra Modi, and the type of very crude nationalism that has a very strong religious component, Hindutva in the case of India, and bringing in alt-right and even Jewish supremacist understanding in the case of Israel, and the way in which new type of alt-right alliances are emerging, in which this religious dimension becomes a glue, which would be unthinkable at the time when socialist Zionism of that was almost anti-clerical was running the show.
This was Arye Dubnow, associate professor in the Department of History at the George Washington University. Arye, thank you so much for this very fascinating and almost comprehensive discussion of Zionism.
Thank you, Roberto. It was my pleasure.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to support the podcast, please share it with others on social media or leave a rating and review. To catch all the latest, follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Jerusalem Unplugged. Thanks, and I'll see you next time.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.